Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Show this week has a very Thanksgiving theme. I'm speaking with the author Ganesh Sitaraman about his new book, Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. If you're listening to this episode during your Thanksgiving travel, I'm sure you're experiencing the following conditions. Number one, your actual in-flight experience is horrible. It's cramped. You're way too stuck next to the person next to you. And there are a variety of fees that have been added on to make it harder and harder to actually get where you're going in a straightforward, price transparent way. Secondly, the actual experience in the airport is horrible. You've got long lines, you have delays, you have cancellations. And then, of course, finally, you're experiencing the fact that in many parts of the country, like the city of Toledo that we speak about, you can't actually get flight service to the parts of the country where you actually need to get to. All of this is happening on top of an airline industry that has gone through boom and bust cycles, has had to constantly be bailed out, despite the fact that before COVID, there were record profits in the industry itself. So in Ganesh's telling, all of this comes together because of public policy choices that were made during the era of airline deregulation in the 1970s and the 1980s. The debate about how we move forward is going to once again stem back to policy choices we can make in the here and now to make things better. So would love to hear what people think about their own experiences or alternative approaches we could take as a country. I hope you all have a happy Thanksgiving and enjoy this conversation. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Ganesh Sitaraman, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat with you. This is a really fascinating book that more than most policy books, and this is obviously by design, is going to resonate with the lived experiences of everyone who's checking out this podcast. So I want to start here with the first line of your book, which gets at why this is a difficult topic. The first line in your book points out, flight is a miracle. It's a miracle that, to quote you, we could have breakfast in Chicago and end up in LA for dinner. Given that fact, whenever I get super pissed off about a disastrous travel situation, I always tell myself, you know what, dude, driving would be way worse. The train would be way worse. Calm down. It's all going to be okay, which I think on a personal level is a useful coping mechanism. But to your point in the book, is not a good societal coping mechanism. So I'd love to hear you kind of respond to that prompt reaction. I think most people will probably share to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. I mean, I'm so grateful for being able to fly. And I think most people are. I mean, when you think about what is involved, you're thousands of feet up in the air in this little tube, moving from place to place, sitting in a chair, having a soda, like that's an astonishing feat of human achievement. And it's really quite extraordinary that we've been able to invent things to be able to do that and to get from place to place so conveniently. But you know, the fact that we are in awe of the technology doesn't mean that we have to live with how frustrating, difficult, irritating our experience using it is. We don't have to live with that situation. And that's part of why I wrote the book and why it's titled Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It, is because I think we can both understand that we appreciate this service, but also that we don't want to experience it in a way that is unfortunate. And I think we have the agency to be able to fix that.
I love that answer because you just did the helpful job of separating the technology from the actual consumer experience and the broader industrial structure that this is operating under. Because when I said that opening story, I'm thankful for the 737. I'm not thankful for the bounty that American Airlines has granted me. And that's what we're focusing on here. This isn't there's obviously a whole other podcast about the 737, but here we're specifically focused on the industry. So I want to start here. Define miserable. What do we mean by flight in the year 2023 is miserable? Because the other thing we should note as well, too, is that flying is also quite safe. When you read any of these like old historical books in the 40s and 50s, it feels like every other chapter, some family member is dying in a plane crash. So I think if we're trying to weight whether the experience has degraded or gotten better or gotten worse, we have to weight that in too. So I'd love to hear your response to that.
Yeah. So I think of flying's misery in two ways that I talk about in the book. The first is, you know, really best characterized as misery, which is the consumer, the passenger experience. This is all the little things that anyone who flies experiences, the fact that there's so many different fare codes that if you book it on a Tuesday or a Saturday, you might get different prices. The person sitting next to you paid three times as much as you did, or maybe you paid three times as much as them. You have to pay extra fees for picking your seat, for sitting by the window or sitting by the aisle or sitting in the front or sitting in the back. You know, they charge extra for the bags. You know, all of those little things, plus on top of that, the delays, the cancellations, the waiting for so long on the tarmac before your plane is free, has a gate freed up for it to park. All of those little things that are frustrating, that are irritating, you know, that's what I mean about the misery of flying for passengers. But I also mean misery, and I use a different word in the book. I couldn't resist in the book, and I call it the turbulence of the industry. And that's that at a broader level, we're now in a place where the airline industry is in this boom-bust cycle, where they have periods where they do extremely well. Then there's a big crisis or demand shock, like 9/11 or COVID. And then the industry needs bailouts or public support programs from taxpayers to stay alive. And in the midst of all of that, we've seen a ton of bankruptcies. We've seen mergers, massive consolidation in the industry into a very small number of players, especially less competition at the top than we had even in the regulated period. And that all of this is actually a bad situation, I think, from an industrial perspective, too. I actually don't want the industry to be constantly at risk of maybe needing to go bankrupt or have a taxpayer bailout. I actually think this is a really essential service for a lot of communities in the country, and we should have a reliable airline system that's a core transportation infrastructure. And so to me, the misery is both parts. It's that as passengers, the experience we have when we fly is you know, leaves much to be desired, let's say. And as a country, I think the industry is not really delivering what ideally I think we should want it to deliver for our economic and social success.
Yeah, and we just focused on the citizenship level and the consumer level, but the other key thing you focus on in your book, and this is the part which feels truly unsustainable, is the critical infrastructure aspect. Under the airline status quo, you're seeing whole swaths of the country, the parts of the country that in many ways we had a whole post-2016 discourse around not leaving behind, are literally being left behind by the airline industry. Can you talk about that side of things?
Yeah, well, you know, Marshall, you've read the book, so you know the answer to this. But for everyone listening or watching this, you know, how many of the big four airlines serve Toledo, Ohio? You know, that's the question I like to ask. And, you know, make it even multiple choice. I'll take one off the table. It's either two, three, or four. No, none. It's zero. Zero of the airlines, the big four, serve Toledo, Ohio. And when you think about that, cities like Toledo losing all big service from big carriers, Dubuque, Iowa losing all service from big carriers, there are some cities that have lost service altogether. And this is a real problem, I think, because if you believe, as I do, that there are tons of talented, extraordinary people all across this country in small towns and mid-sized cities and rural places in the West, in the Midwest, in the South, you know, not just on the coasts. Part of what makes for a vibrant economy in an area is having infrastructure. And airports are important infrastructure. You know, I don't think there's a person in the town who would say, I really want to, I have my great idea, I'm going to start my Fortune 500 company here in a place that doesn't have an airport or doesn't have any air service or only has service, you know, once a day to one city. And it's hard to do that because you need to have that kind of commerce and connection to commerce that travel provides. And I think, you know, that's why we don't see that as much. And so to me, part of the reason we need this kind of geographic dispersal of access to this resource is partly about economic growth and opportunity all across the country. And I think that's a value that at least I have, and I think a lot of other people in the country share.
And I think you get, in the way you're writing this book in this moment where, to certain degrees, interesting people on both sides of the aisle are kind of reworking this like post-1980s, like neoliberal economic model. And it seems the clear takeaway here, because that gets a little foofy, to make it very literal, we have an efficient outcome when it comes to whether or not Toledo's served by, you know, the maximum number of airlines, but we don't quite have, I would say, a fair or a resilient level of support there, which is a key way of like understanding the way we should need to reassess these issues.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I talked about the economic growth and commercial aspects a minute ago, but if you think about resilience too, the concentration of airports into ever bigger hubs and then these spokes, that model is actually one that is not very resilient. And the reason why, as is true in all kind of networks of this type, is if your big node goes down for some reason. So let's say there's weather in Dallas, high winds, you know, that could actually shut down not just flights in Dallas, but because Dallas is such an important hub, flights all across the country can be delayed or canceled on a huge scale. Whereas if you had a more dispersed network, depending on how it's designed, you might actually have more reliability. And so to me, these are values and questions that we might really care about. And you could even think of some of this in terms of efficiency. It's just not what's most efficient for the big four airlines. It's actually what's most efficient in a dynamic sense for the economy, because certainly when, you know, a third of the flights or something like that are canceled from one airport or delayed from one airport, that actually affects a lot of people. It affects all their businesses. If people are traveling for business, you know, it affects communities all over the place. There's big economic costs to those things too. We need to think about that as well. And I think that's not really been in our purview. And so you could frame it as efficiency, but I think we should want to frame it more broadly than that and think about what does it mean to have reliable services.
And I would love for you to basically tear down everything I'm about to say, because just reading your book, this is my kind of conventional wisdom, popular understanding of the state of the modern airplane industry, which is, I'm sure, depending on how on Twitter you are, you've seen like that photo of a well-upholstered, there's a nice juicy ham being served by the flight attendants. It's in the 1950s of a bunch of Don Draper looking guys. And everyone basically says, look, like this is how flying used to be. It's so terrible, but it doesn't look like this anymore. You have your cramped leg space. You don't have any place to stow your bags, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the thing that smarter people tend to say in response to that is, well, it's true that flying used to be like that, but the reason why we gave that up is we deregulated. And though we don't have as much leg space, everything is cheaper now. We have all this mass consumer access, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's basically where we come down to. Where from your study of this history and your evaluation, this is a public policy challenge, would you say this conventional story I just told either gets something wrong or misinterprets an outcome?
Yeah, I think it gets a lot wrong in thinking about what deregulation did. And I think to understand that, I think it's helpful to go back to a little history, because I suspect a lot of people may not know the kind of broader policy history of airlines. And to just do it real quickly, you know, we've really, since the Wright brothers, I think of it, have gone through something like four phases. I mean, you could split it up however you want, but I think there's like four phases in how we think about our history. The first is the early years, where there was just a lot of subsidies, usually in the form of airmail by the post office, to get us from the Wright brothers to having something that was like airplanes that were really flying around. But let's put that part aside, the first couple of decades. The big first era is the 1930s to the 1970s. And in this period, airlines were in a period of regulated competition. And what Congress did was they wanted to have a stable, reliable system. And so they set a regulatory system in which there was a federal regulator called the Civil Aeronautics Board, or the CAB. And the CAB allocated routes to different airlines. That means they said to a certain airline, you can fly from place one to place two. A different airline will fly from these other cities to other cities. They also set the rates for flights too. And these rates were in the early ages defined to be just and reasonable. They just couldn't charge too much. And they had to be fair to everyone. Later, they got more sophisticated and would actually set rates that were tied to the distance that you're flying. So you paid more if you were flying a longer distance, you paid less if you're flying a shorter distance. And the goal of this system was both to maintain a degree of competition. So there would be some competition, but not so much that the airlines would go bankrupt or need tons of subsidies to stay alive, and not so little that they would become monopolists or be too powerful in any city or overall. And then the other goal was to ensure geographic access. And so they allocated these routes so that airlines would get some routes that were high volume, you know, your New York's to Boston's, and some that were going to be less so, you know, rural Alaska, for example, where we want service, but, you know, it's highly unlikely that's going to be a high traffic route most of the time. So that was the system. And it was consciously thought of as a kind of public utility style system, that this was a utility that was a transportation infrastructure. And what happened in the 70s was folks said, this is actually kind of like a cartel that's sponsored by the government, and we should move to free market competition. That'll be better. We could have dozens of airlines flying. At one point, you know, there's even a suggestion that there would be 200 airlines flying if we deregulated the system. And all we need to do is let them fly wherever they want, whenever they want, and to charge whatever they want, and it'll all be great. And so that's what the move was in the 70s. And
quick pause before we get out of the 70s, because I love this. It gets at the history being complicated. This isn't just like a right-wing Milton Friedman thing. You actually have left critics like Ralph Nader saying, hey, wait a second, another way of describing the system you just described is you have this airline industry and you have this big regulatory apparatus and there's a revolving door and there's literal examples of corruption during the Watergate era between the Nixon administration, like the committee to reelect the president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't as if, because I think we could kind of tell like the neoliberal story and this like kind of like Milton Friedman ruined everything way sense, but there were some status quo aspects that people, for a variety of reasons, didn't like.
That's right. But the other, I think that's right. The other interesting thing about the strange bedfellows of the 70s, which is, you know, Nader, but it's also Ted Kennedy and Stephen Breyer, who are really leading the charge on the left. And it's
the future Supreme Court justice.
Jimmy Carter, who signs the bill, ultimately deregulating the airlines. But what's interesting about that is, in a sense, it is in a proto-neoliberal thing where both sides, left and right, were pushing forward on deregulation. And so if, you know, there are a number of folks, don't have to get into a conversation about neoliberalism unless you want to, but one version of defining that is on the economic front, main components were deregulation, privatization, you know, globalization or trade liberalization and fiscal austerity. And in that context, deregulation was shared. It was a thing that happened on both sides over the next, you know, few decades. And airline deregulation is maybe one of the earliest, most prominent examples of this kind of bipartisan consensus to move in the more market-friendly direction.
And one last thing before you go on.
Yeah.
And this is what's so interesting. It's both the earliest, but I think it's probably the one that people think as the least politicized. Trade policy, very political. Deregulation of other industries, very political. Healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Most people think, oh, like airlines are just airlines. I think the reason why this book is so interesting is you're trying to offer folks a new narrative way of approaching and thinking about an industry which they don't see as political, but is actually deeply political in its very nature.
And this gets exactly to your original question where we started, which is, you know, the folks in the 70s pushed to deregulate and they said we were going to get all these benefits, but one of the things that's largely not well understood, I think, at least in the, you know, you mentioned Twitter and the kind of conventional Twitterverse or Xverse, I don't know what it's called now, is that a lot of things were moving in the right direction during regulation. You know, and as you started, you have to remember that in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you know, these were prop planes. We were before the jet age for part of this. There were lots of airline crashes. People were scared about flying in a serious way. And over that period of time, from the 30s to the 70s, the volume of people flying going up that whole time. The prices going down that whole time. New technologies, first jets, then wide-bodied jets coming online. So there was a lot of growth and improvement in this. The trends were all pointing in the right direction when you look at the data over that period. And I think to your question about, you know, what's wrong with the deregulation story, at a first pass, it's that when you look at some of the data, things like prices, things like, you know, how many people are flying, it's not a giant discontinuity that happens with deregulation, that somehow you have deregulation and all the prices go down. In fact, prices were going down before at about the same rate that they went down afterwards. And even the people who were proponents of deregulation later on admitted that that deregulation didn't mean across the board prices going down, that, you know, there was a reshaping of prices, that some places had higher prices, some places had lower prices. And that had changed during deregulation. And so it was a redistribution of where the costs were going and how prices were being set up. Not just everything is better and you get cheaper prices.
Well, what's interesting too, and correct me, because I think I'm going to confuse this, but you already had, before the end of the regulation, airlines start to add new perks. So you had, for example, there's a piano bar, and you start to see early rewards programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just like, I did not realize. I really just, and this is why I started with that meme image on Twitter. I just see the 1950s, 60s Don Draper version, and then I see today. But I think the point of the story you're telling is actually even just 10 or 12 years later, we'd actually moved quite a bit closer to what we think of as normal air travel than we would have if we just said, what happened after 1978?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting parts in doing this story. And it's one of the places where I think the advocates for deregulation were a little bit bound, which is either their argument was you really needed legislative deregulation of the whole thing, or you didn't. And it was hard for them to explain. I think they were able to do a lot of things under the regulated system about adding super savers and discount fares and discounts for certain groups. And, you know, there was a lot of innovation happening in that period already that was compatible, at least some people thought, with the regulated system. And maybe meant you didn't need to do full-on deregulation in order to capture some of the benefits without some of the downsides.
You know, and this is the way I was thinking about the book when I'm looking at my notes. There are a couple big debates that you're obviously taking. You're taking specific sides of these debates, but a real big debate here is, are airlines best conceived of as utilities, like water, or are they something that with the proper governmental approach could be run in a free market manner? And this is also interesting too, because a line you had in the book, which I thought was so interesting, which is the problem with debating whether deregulation worked is it depends on when you're looking at it. So if we're looking at 1995, okay, like this looks kind of great. If we're looking at three bailouts later, that's an entirely different approach. On the other hand, if I think about the bailouts, we could note that like before the COVID bailouts, the airline industry had record profits. And you start to say to yourself, like, well, if they hadn't done their stock buybacks, they would have had the money to weather a rainy day. So this isn't quite like purely a free market problem. It's a problem of bad management. And it's a problem of maybe we let an airline fail so that executives moving forward will know they don't just get the handout generically there. So I'd love for you just to kind of like articulate the different sides and where you stand on the, to what degree is this a utility and to what degree is this a free market thing?
Yeah. But before I go broad there, I just want to say one thing about that last part about letting the airline fail after COVID or letting all of them fail. And the reason why that doesn't happen is sort of similar to the too big to fail banks question, which is it's a revealing moment when that happens, because it actually says this is an industry that is so essential and so important to commerce and the economy that we won't let them fail. That's not the same as a restaurant. Regular restaurant, one-off, put aside COVID, you know, but an ordinary thing. If you're serving crummy food that nobody likes, no one's coming in to rescue you, like, that's your fault. We let that restaurant go under. No one thinks that's an essential business for society, for the country, something like that. That's not how we feel about airlines. If all the airlines went bankrupt and we didn't have air service because they all got liquidated, that would be a serious problem. They could be restructured instead of liquidated. There's lots of technical things, but it's a moment to say there's something different going on here. And this is how people thought of airlines for a long time, was as a utility. They're an essential service for the country. We need them for commerce. We want them for commerce. We need them for communication. There are all of these benefits that we get out of airlines. And importantly, their economics are different than the restaurant or a manufacturer of coffee mugs or office desk chairs. And the reason why their economics are different is because these are businesses that have high capital costs. It's hard to get into the airline business in terms of how much it costs. These are industries in which there are network effects and economies of scale. It's better to fly an airline that flies to more places. You can get more places. That's a beneficial thing. And that means more people want to fly on those airlines. And this is also an industry that has some barriers to entry that are really hard to get around. You know, there's only a certain number of airports. You could even imagine expanding the number, but they're still going to be limited. There's only a certain number of runways. And also, you can't have planes landing anytime they want because they're going to crash into each other. And so you have to have coordination, which requires air traffic control, and it requires making sure. And that's all a limitation. That's all congestion on what the air traffic system looks like. And so when you put all these things together, you actually have an industry that's not like manufacturing mugs or tables or running a restaurant, where it actually doesn't really matter for society in terms of externalities if there's eight, you know, restaurants on the same street. We might actually call that a vibrant street. But, you know, if there are multiple airlines, if there are eight airplanes all trying to land on the same runway at the exact same time, like, this is actually a crisis. That's a real problem. And so we have to solve for that. And that means allocating scarce resources. And so this is a very different industry than other industries. And I think that's why I think of it as a utility. Now, what's really interesting to me is that the people on my side of that story included the leading people in industry in the 70s. You know, I tell the story in the book.
Well, that's what Rolf Nader says they'd say.
That's true. But you know,
well, wait. Could you actually respond please make your point, but I want to come back to that. I think it is an important thing I want to revisit.
Yeah. So the story is you know, I have this character in the book. I mean, character, a real person, Robert Crandall, who I think probably is a character. I've never met him, but was the, you know, legendary head of American throughout the 80s. And in the 70s, you know, when deregulation's happening, he's an executive there, and he comes to one of the hearings and says, you know, you're going to wreck this industry. You guys, you don't know what you're doing here. And he says that to Breyer, and who's the chief counsel to Ted Kennedy on the committee that's doing a big workup on airline deregulation. And when they deregulate the industry, Crandall's one of the fiercest competitors. He's in the 80s doing all kinds of things to keep American at the top of the pack in what's really a cutthroat period of competition. And by the 2000s, retired, you know, he's back out talking and saying, look, this was a wrong decision. This is a utility-like service, and we need to regulate it that way for it to be a flourishing industry. And look how bad it is now. And I think there's something interesting about these figures that understood that the rules of the game is what set how their business was going to work. They happily played within it when it was a regulated system and thought that was the right way to do it. But when they deregulated it, they played within those rules. They knew how it worked, and you know, they fought, you know, hard to stay at the top of the pack. But after they were out of the game, you know, we're back to saying, like, actually, this is bad as a public policy matter. And so I think there's something interesting that the people who were really close to understanding industry had the view this is actually a utility-like service, not a competitive one.
And I just want to go back to the Rolf Nader point for a second, because I actually don't agree with the Rolf Nader point, because it's logical. It's actually like a deeply... And Rolf Nader is kind of like a left libertarian. So like, it's a deeply libertarian point of view that basically means that we shouldn't regulate anything, because hypothetically, anyone could get on board with anything. The people who are regulating liquor could obviously like get on the boards of liquor companies afterwards. And it seems to me that when we talk about that, the answer is that we need like rigorous enforcement and surveillance of the regulators in the first place. You can pass all sorts of different laws. You don't have to just conclude that the fact that there was corruption means we can't regulate in the first place. But yeah, what is your response to the Rolf Nader argument? That's my response, but I'm curious what your response is.
What's interesting about Nader's argument, which is really about government capture, the regulators were captured by the industry and doing the bidding of the industry. And what's interesting about that, you know, to go back to our neoliberal conversation, is that was one of the key arguments of George Stigler and folks in the Chicago School about regulation and the case against it. So again, it's a nice place of overlap between liberals and conservatives. But what seems very odd to me about this is, first, you know, it's a real jump to say that everyone in government is corrupt and captured. That's one. You know, and two, you have to compare that to the alternative systems that we might have. And it's not obvious, you know, one is better than the other. You can't compare perfect markets, utopian markets, to real life government. If we're going to do that, we got to compare utopian markets and utopian government, or real life markets and real life government. We can't compare mismatched versions of the ideals. But the other response to Nader is, why is the response to that to just give up the game and say we should never do anything as a people or as a country together? And I think that's a very weird response, that it says we just shouldn't have a government do anything, as opposed to, as you said, you know, well, let's make rules against revolving door going in and out of the industry, or let's make rules about, you know, where your campaign contributions are from. Like, there's any number of ways we could think about these problems that don't require us to take the all or nothing approach. In general, I guess I tend to have the feeling that if you're talking in all or nothing terms, you know, you might not be doing something exactly right.
because, and this is a public policy episode, we find that it's not really Manichaean. It's more that there are trade-offs. We're having to decide, like, what of these sets of things, what are we going to preference? Once again, that's a political, especially in this case, that's a deeply political decision. We have to conceive of it as such. So before we get into the last section on your actual proposed fixes, I'd love for you to explain what happened during COVID and the aftermath and how that should shape how we think of the next steps and how it comes to fixing the various issues we've described.
Yeah. Well, so as a way into that, let me go back once more.
Your platform, do what you need to do.
Let me do a quick version of the rest of the history, which will go quite quickly. So, you know, after deregulation in 78, what we didn't get was the kind of utopian dream world of 200 airlines flying around efficiently. What we actually got was much more like a Hunger Games for the airlines, where you had all these new entrants coming in the 80s, undercutting the big guys on prices, not flying to places like Alaska, you know, just taking the high volume routes. And they didn't have unions in a bunch of cases. They didn't offer any, you know, meals or anything. There were no frills services. And that existed for a little bit, but the big airlines fought back. They undercut the new upstarts by price. They sandwiched flights on both sides of the new entrance flights in order to push them out of the business. They jacked up the prices afterwards. There were dozens of bankruptcies and mergers. I mean, it was a chaotic system in the 80s. And where it really shook out over the decades is where I think we've been recently, which is, you know, the kind of third big stage, which is a type of monopoly capitalism, basically, where we have a very small number of airlines. I use monopoly not literally there, but oligopoly, if you want to be more precise about it. But we have a very small number of airlines that are really defined by, you know, not really competition, because we have less competition than we've had before. You know, the top four airlines now have a higher market share than they did in the 70s in regulation. So that's a big shift in where we've come. And I think that's important for understanding the COVID and post-COVID moment, because, you know, where we were before COVID, as you alluded to earlier, was airlines were doing extremely well, making money hand over fist. You had one airline executive who said they didn't think they were ever going to lose money again. And then you have COVID, this big demand shock, people stop flying. And the conventional thing that would happen in that situation is a business like an airline would either furlough or lay off workers. They'd shut things down for a while, and then they'd have to restart operations later when demand picks up again. That might be okay for some businesses. I mean, I think what we saw in COVID is it would be devastating for a lot of businesses. But
some heavily capitalized, that's the key thing.
Well, even for restaurants, right? I mean, you think about restaurant workers, you think about, you know, those small margins on restaurants, right? There are downsides for a lot of businesses, as we saw in COVID, for this. But if you're an airline, it's not just the high capital, which makes you a little bit different. The other difference is the amount of time it takes for you to bounce back, which is you have to have pilots who are trained and have done a certain amount of flying, you know, so that they can be able to fly safely and have the training to do that. You have to have flight attendants who are trained and who know what they're doing. You're going to have customer service people who know how the system works. And if you are just hiring everybody new and it's their first day, they're not actually going to be able to do any of that stuff at the scale that you need when travel perks back up. And that's exactly what we saw. So the CARES Act, which was the COVID support package for payroll for all the people in the industry, was actually really important, because it meant that we didn't end up in the devastating crisis we would have had in airlines, which would have been way fewer people working in these airlines, a much bigger need for the airlines to hire new people, not being able to get them back online faster. Last year, 2022, would have been significantly worse without that package. But at the same time, you know, to me, and the argument I make in the book is that this whole episode, this boom, this bust, this need for this package actually should teach us something bigger about this industry, which is we care a lot about this being a reliable service. And why are we in a situation where the money is flowing so freely and well with huge profits before COVID, and then we need all these support programs on the back end? You know, this is not a rational way to run a public policy around this industry. If we're going to be doing that, it's kind of like banking, you know, do we really want them to be too big to fail? And if they're going to be too big to fail, shouldn't there be some regulation that comes along with that to prevent that from being the case? And so that's really my view, is this was essential, but you know, it shows actually the problem with the structure of our system right now that we allow this to happen.
So I'd love to hear in these last few minutes, like, what form does regulation take? And they, so for example, when you're listing, okay, so go back to the start of the episode, you listed out the various ways that flying is miserable. And then we listed the infrastructure issues. What are regulations that could at least arrest to a certain degree those realities?
So I think the first thing I'd say is, you know, I think of this as starting with three big principles, which is what drives it for me. So principle number one, no more flyover country. We shouldn't have a system where big chunks of the country, medium-sized cities, small cities are losing air service. We want service to be everywhere. That's the value. People can disagree, but I think that should be one of the principles. Second principle, no bailouts, no bankruptcies. I actually want a successful, healthy, reliable airline industry that doesn't need to be bailed out and isn't constantly going bankrupt. Third principle, fair and transparent pricing. It's gotten way too complicated for passengers. It's gotten much harder. Now, the interesting thing that I found in doing the book, and when you think about the utility style system of regulation, is that it wasn't a kind of one-to-one problem solution where you'd say, well, the problem is I don't like the meal, so let's regulate better meals. That's not the system. The system was, let's design a system, a structure that creates incentives or that works in a certain way that within that structure, you actually solve multiple problems all at once. And to me, that's where I think we should be trying to go. And that's not to say we can't push for passengers' bill of rights, minimum seat sizes. That's fine. I think we can do those things. But a better way to do it, you know, the next time there's a crisis, maybe, would be to start thinking about these broader ideas. And so I'll just frame out one on the geography front, which is, you know, imagine a system where you say, let's have a NFL-style draft for cities. There's small cities, medium-sized cities that aren't getting much service. The biggest airlines all get a draft pick number, and they have to pick cities from a list that are qualified, and they got to serve them at an affordable price that's regulated with a certain amount of frequency per day and week. And if you did something like that, that would mean a number of things. It would mean they would actually have to have regulated prices there, which means they'd have to address those somewhere else. It would mean they'd have to provide service there. It would mean a limited number of fare classes because you couldn't have dynamic pricing all over the place. You'd have to have affordable rates there to prevent bad behavior in those places where there might be lower volume. That would actually shift incentives in a bunch of ways. If we combine that with a proposal to deconcentrate airports, so you don't have the situation where there are these mega hubs, Atlanta, Dallas, and so on. Mm-hmm. But instead, you had more hubs, but smaller, with more competition between them. So you don't have 70% of one airline at a hub. But, you know, like in the regulated period, you have more like 25% at a hub. That would be more competition, which would also mean lower prices in some of those places, maybe better service if airlines want to differentiate themselves that way. So I think there are different ways we could see improvements structurally if we tackle things like that, rather than trying to play whack-a-mole on, you know, the thing that makes us frustrated every week or every year.
I think what's interesting there is, once again, you're not, this is one of the options, but this isn't a call to just nationalize the airlines and create the, you know, bureau of, you know, airline seat management. Because to a certain degree, there still is competition in this system, and you could leave up to competition seat sizing, the baggage allowances, like, et cetera. So it's just kind of, it's useful to kind of understand that this isn't quite a pure, we're going to solve this by just like imbuing more bureaucracy onto things style dynamic.
And you also don't have to say it's all or nothing there too. So like, you know, we think about seat sizing, which is actually pretty critical to safety, right? If there's a crisis, can everyone get out? And if you're stuck in your seat because there's only 12 inches in front of you, you know, if they keep shrinking, we may be in that world one day. It'll be harder for people to exit in an emergency. Like, so there's safety concerns. You maybe want minimums for some of these things, but, you know, maybe there should be competition above and beyond those minimums, you know, that have real safety and related considerations.
So the last question, taking us back to where we started, I would just love to hear as succinct as you want to make it, articulation of what should we expect from an airline industry? Because it seems like we expect degrading service. And as long as we get where we're going eventually, we're basically okay with it. I think this is probably the status quo mentality. What should the mentality be at a consumer and, frankly, because this is political, at a citizen level? What should they be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that gets back to my principles. You know, so I think at a countrywide level, I think what we should expect and desire and even demand, because, you know, airlines get a lot of privileges from the government and us, the people, to be able to fly around. That's just not something you can just do. And, you know, as a trade for those privileges, they should have some obligations. I think that should include service to smaller and mid-sized places so that we have geographic access. I think that should include a kind of reliability so that they're more resilient and don't have as much by way of delays, cancellations, big shocks if there's an issue at a single airport, for example. And at the macro level, they should have some, you know, policies built in place to address, you know, foreseeable, you know, once in a decade shocks that might happen to prevent the need for bailouts and other things. For passengers, I think we should expect and demand a simpler system of pricing where you know what you're getting, where it's not at the whim of the airline that changes constantly based on, you know, data collection or times of day or other kinds of random factors like that. And I think that we should have a system of service quality that, as I said, has some minimums in place that mean you never have to be worried that it's going to constantly get worse than this. And, you know, where this is a question for debate, and people can obviously disagree about that. But I think we can all agree that a system that, you know, creates conflicts, you know, you see things like small seats leading to people putting their seat back and, you know, disagreements on planes, yelling, violence in some cases, you know, that's not a good system. And we should have some things that at a minimum address, you know, the really worst case outcomes that we get in the passenger experience.
Last actual question. How long should we expect the fallout from COVID to last? Because that's part of the staffing chain. That's part of the staffing shortage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, are we going to be back to baseline, like, let's say in 2025, 2026?
No, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, A, because predictions are hard, especially about the future, as they say.
Yeah.
But second is, it's possible that where we will end up is not in a place that's a bounce back, and that's not the right way to think about it. But the right way to think about it is in an age of, you know, as I said, more monopoly-like capitalism, where there's actually not that much competition. If you're an airline, you may be better off with a little bit less service, fuller planes, because fuller planes, scarce resource, high demand, more, you can charge more. And as passengers, what are you going to do? Start an airline? I mean, you can't really do that and serve 100 cities, 50 cities, like 20 cities. You know, this is a hard thing to do at scale. So I think the lack of competition in this area also means that it may be the case that we don't even see a kind of bounce back to the past, but we see something different that ultimately might be even more miserable for passengers.
That is an excellent place to end. Ganesh, thank you so much for joining me on The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.